The Sunstone Symposium. It is a session concerning the changing realities in South Africa. It says the church is as an agent for change. That will be clarified. We have with us Brian Sellers Peterson. He is an executive director of the Episcopal Center for South African Ministry, and he is a minister of the Episcopal Church. He has his bachelor's degree from the University of Minnesota, a master's degree from the Fuller Theological Seminary, and 4 to 5 years in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, as a youth minister with the Anglican Church. We also have with us Dr. William Lai. He is a PhD from UCLA in African Prehistory and Ethnography. He's a professor and vice president of university relations at Utah State University. He taught at Ritz College and then at USU for 21 years. He has taught, traveled, researched, and engaged in AID development work in Africa on 6 trips. We are pleased to have them and anxious to see what things they have to tell us. Dr. Lai, would you like to begin and clarify?
Thank you. I'd just like to explain that the title which Mr. Peterson has used for his paper needs to be understood. He's referring to the church in an aggregate sense, and he will talk about the role of the church, the Christian church, in an apartheid society. So it will not deal directly with Latter-day Saint Church in South Africa.
I think I have a very daunting task this afternoon. Usually I can stand up and give a speech off the cuff, or I can even from a prepared script, and maybe one or two questions, but never have had the experience of being responded to by someone of such an eminent stature as the professor here, and I will look forward to his comments. The apartheid system of South Africa, which legitimizes racial segregation, has its roots in the Christian churches of South Africa. In the mid-19th century, some churches there made a conscious decision to accept racial segregation at the Eucharist table. A few years later, this practice was expanded to permit separate congregations demarcated along racial lines. At first, this practice was confined to the Dutch Reformed churches of South Africa, and even there was acknowledged as a necessary expedient due to the weakness of some of the brethren. Quote. By 1948, when the Afrikaner constituents of these churches gained political power, their theologians had concluded that apartheid was biblically mandated and morally defensible. Moreover, various practices of racial segregation had spread to most other Christian denominations in South Africa. Many argue that apartheid began as a Christian heresy, which later spread in the political dimension of South Africa's national life. In the contemporary interdependent world, this evil influences all societies, national, economic, ecclesiastical, all of which are intertwined with the fabric of apartheid. While apartheid tries to divide people along racial lines, Christ's calling is inclusive. Even at this time of severe polarization, we are seeing unprecedented opportunity for the breaking through of a new society. The South African Church, straddling the vast racial divide, is called to a unique ministry of reconciliation. The allegiance and respect which it receives from diverse corners of its society is unparalleled and represents an encouraging opportunity which must not be squandered. Let me start from the beginning. Thousands of years before Christ, the Khoisan roamed South Africa. A semi-nomadic people, they lived and roamed the grasslands, marshes, marshlands, and deserts. They were short of stature, with a yellowish-brown complexion. They lived on wild plants, nuts, fruits, small animals, rodents, and sometimes larger animals, deer, antelope, giraffes, yes, and even hippos. Like the native people of North America, they were extremely religious and had great respect for the spirit world and, quote, the Great Spirit. Around 2,000 years ago, they started to herd, primarily sheep and later cattle. The herder clans also learned to make pottery. They were called the Khoikhoi. Another subgroup of the Khoisan emerged called the Nama, who settled around what is now Namibia, which just this past year has gained its independence. Their languages have a number of cliques. For those of you who've seen the South African-produced movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, you will remember the so-called natives speaking with this highly musical and complicated language. And just a side note, I personally found this movie quite racist and a bit exploitative. These cliques were integrated, but I still would recommend people seeing it. It is entertaining. It does give you a window into life in Southern Africa. These cliques were integrated into other African languages such as Xhosa and Zulu. Somewhere between the 3rd and 6th centuries AD, the Bantu, as they are known commonly, people arrived in what is now called the Transvaal, which is around Pretoria and Johannesburg. These people had iron-making abilities, which gave them the ability to cultivate grain for a staple diet, which also helped to provide white milk and meat from goats, sheep, and cattle. Because soil then became eroded and lost its fertility, these groups then migrated to the south and to the west. As they went, they would build their houses and villages all over again, unlike the Khoisan groups, who were nomadic. Groups of the Bantu include the Nguni, which include Xhosa, Swazi, Zulu, and the Tswana and Sotho groupings. West of the Nguni settlements, the Tswana settled around the Orange and Limpopo rivers. The Pedi and Sotho are subsections of Tswana. Around the 13th century, the Tswanas built stone-walled towns and villages and built states through the control of cattle ownership and control of mining, manufacturing, and trade. They spread out towards the Kalahari Desert to the west and south of the Vaal River. Portuguese and English ships explored the coastlines of South Africa during the 16th and 17th centuries. And in 1652, the Dutch East India Company founded the first settlement of Europeans at the Cape of Good Hope. This was to be a halfway stop to markets in the East, where they could stock up on fresh water, meat, and vegetables before proceeding east. They almost immediately started extensive trading relations with the Khoisan, but this did not last. In 1659, a war broke out between the Dutch settlers and the Khoisan. The so-called colored population of South Africa, set apart from the black population, is primarily located in the Cape Province and numbers 2.5 million. They originated by inbreeding of European settlers and sailors, Asian and African slaves, and the Khoisan. Many of these people are accepted as white today. In 1795, the British Empire took the Cape by force to protect what they saw as a safe passage and a strategic place for its war with the French. This introduced another tribe to the subcontinent. In 1820, a large migration of English settled in the Eastern Cape region around Port Elizabeth and Grahamstown. South Africa continues to be settled from the four corners of the earth. It is a rich country with large deposits of gold and diamonds, with strategic metals that include uranium, platinum, chromium, manganese, and vanadium. There has been an influx of Portuguese from Angola and Mozambique after these countries attained their independence from Portugal. Working class British and Irish continue to settle South Africa looking for a better life, sometimes at the expense of black South Africans. And we now see Eastern Europeans coming to South Africa with technical skills so badly needed to maintain a status quo. And of course, cheap labor continues to come from Mozambique, Lesotho, Swaziland, Zambia, Malawi, and so on, to keep the mines running, and oftentimes they undercut the legitimate demands of black South Africans of equal pay for equal work. Apartheid is an Afrikaans word that means literally apartness. It has been an official form of social engineering in South Africa since 1948, when the Afrikaner Nationalist Party took control of the government, and has been practiced for centuries before in a de facto manner. Many of the apartheid laws that were enacted after 1948 were on the books as British law for decades beforehand. These laws impact the daily lives of every single person who lives in South Africa. The people who are classified as black, much more so. When I first moved to South Africa in 1979 as, quote, a white, albeit of the American variety, I had perks that no black had access to. Some of the best beaches in the world, half-empty and luxurious movie theaters, the best railway cars, more police patrolling the streets of the suburb I lived in, and almost no dirt roads. In 1979, the white population of South Africa enjoyed one of the highest standards of living of any subgroup in the world, and the blacks one of the worst, even though they too lived in one of the world's richest countries. It is important to note that it is, at least from my perspective, a grievous mistake to measure black South Africans' standard of living with other black Africans on the continent of Africa. It is frequently heard from protagonists of the South African system that, quote, our Africans have it better than any other Africans in Africa. They have more cars per capita, better education, more hospitals, etc., end quote. It is important to see that no other country in Africa has more wealth, and no other country in Africa has a more unequal distribution of wealth. The only legitimate comparisons, I believe, are between South Africans, irregardless of their racial heritage or classification. In the past few years, many apartheid laws have been removed from the law books, such as the Native Laws Amendment Act, number 54 of 1972, which mandated that any black South African born in South Africa may not visit an urban area for more than 72 hours without obtaining a special permit. The Immorality Amendment Act, number 23 of 1957, which forbade unlawful carnal intercourse or any immoral or indecent act between a white person on the one hand and an African, Indian, or colored on the other, has gone the route of the dinosaur as well. Sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, especially around some of these so-called petty apartheid laws. Special Force Order 025A/69 allowed for the use of binoculars, tape recorders, cameras, and two-way radios to trap offenders of the Immorality Act. The press would often detail how the police, under specific police guidelines, would check bedsheets for warmth and stains to enter into evidence. The Mixed Marriages Amendment Act, number 21 of 1968, has been abolished as well. But the Group Areas Act, number 41 of 1950, and the Population Registration Act, number 30 of 1950, are both still in place and impact couples who are legally married now across the so-called colored line. But they are unable to legally live together because of the aforementioned laws, although they can now legally marry. They can live together if they appear before a racial reclassification board to request a change in their race. The pillars of apartheid still stand. They include the Population Registration Act, the Group Areas Act, the various Internal Security Acts, the Bantu Homelands Citizen Act, and voting rights on a common roll. The church. The major churches in South Africa, and just for those of you who like to take notes and interested in numbers, it's a helpful thing for me to run through this quickly. I went through a number of books and could not find numbers for LDS. I'm sure that someone will know that. I come from my own Christian heritage, which sometimes is not as inclusive as we claim to be, and I apologize for that. The Anglican Church has 1,676 members, 80% of whom are black. The Baptists have 170,000. The Congregational Church, 355,000. The Dutch Reformed family of churches, which have been and continue to be divided according to race. There are 1.5 million who belong to the White Dutch Reformed Church, 900,000 who belong to the Black Dutch Reformed Church, 500,000 people who belong to the Colored or the Dutch Reformed Church, commonly known as the Sending Kerk, and 1,000 people belong to the Reformed Church of Africa, which is reserved for people of Indian heritage. There are other Dutch Reform churches, the Hervormerde, 150-some thousand, and the Nederduits Hervormde, with 225,000. Lutherans, 873,000. Methodists, almost 2 million. Presbyterians, close to 2 million, as are the Roman Catholics. And a very important statistic is that the African independent churches have 3.5 million members. The historical origins of the African church are complex, fascinating, and sad. The Tswana and Sotho called God light, protector, and father. The mere mention of God's sacred name would often mean. This is quite similar to the Hebrew and the use of the name Yahweh. After the Dutch colonized the Cape, they eventually brought out clergy to minister to the European settlers. During the first half century of the Cape Colony, there was virtually no missionary activity amongst the Khoikhoi. Only in 1713 was an African baptized, a woman named Eva, who was married to a Danish settler. The earliest organized missionary outreach was done by German Moravians. The largest missionary effort was provided by the London Missionary Society, commonly known as LMS, which was founded in 1795. Although the LMS was non-denominational, it had a decidedly British Congregationalist flavor. Most of the funds and personnel were from British Congregationalists. The LMS was a part of the larger evangelical revivalist movement of that period that was primarily occupied with the saving of individual souls. But as was the case, they were intertwined with the empire's building pursuits, the Mother England's empire, that is, and supported the empire's commercial investment and political interests. This eventually led to separation of races in the church. Yet there was a liberal and abolitionist strain in the LMS, epitomized by the famous LMS missionary superintendent, John Philip. The Dutch Reformed Church in South Africa had close ties to the church in Holland until 1824, when they had their own synod. They were involved in extensive mission work with, quote, colored people, As with the LMS, this led to segregation. The Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church in 1829 had as a principle that the Word of God called for communion to be served to all members, quote, without distinction of color or origin, end quote. In 1857, this action was reversed. They decided that the, quote, heathen must enjoy Christian privileges, end quote, in separate buildings if whites objected to having communion with them. What was an exception became a rule. This led to separate mission churches, which I've mentioned earlier. The Black Dutch Reformed Church, the Colored Dutch Reformed Church, and the Church for the Indian Population. As with the general population, the church in South Africa is primarily black. The character of the church is largely paternalistic, racially segregated, and imperialistic. This is the outcome of 3 centuries of mission heritage. Yet black Christians have never believed that they are spiritually inferior. The present generation of African church leaders, including the Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, Desmond Tutu, Dr. Frank Chikane, General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, Dr. Alan Busack, former moderator of the Dutch Reformed Sending or Mission Church, and president of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, and countless others have called the churches of the world to join them in their struggle against racism and injustice as spiritual imperatives. Archbishop Tutu echoes this refrain when he says, "My passionate opposition to the evil and pernicious policy of apartheid has nothing to do with a political or any other ideology. It has everything to do with my faith as a Christian and my understanding of the imperatives of the gospel of Jesus Christ." In a reply to the then state president of South Africa, Mr. P.W. Botha, Archbishop Tutu stated that, quote, "My theological position derives from the Bible and from the teachings of the church, both of which predate Marxism and the African National Congress by several centuries." The forming of many and various African independent churches in South Africa is a way the black South Africans have resisted European domination of their religious culture. There are 3.5 million Africans that belong to the 3,000 churches that make up the African Independent Churches Association. These churches vary in size from congregations of a few to the 200,000 member congregations that belong to the Zion Christian Church denomination. It is my view that the struggle for freedom in South Africa cannot be adequately understood apart from an analysis of the role of religion, especially in the land of apartheid. Religion has played an important part in the defense of apartheid as well as in the critique of it. For example, the unusually close relationship between the present ruling party of the Nationalists and the Dutch Reformed Church puts church polity and national politics in spheres that are essentially indistinguishable in South Africa. The South African church community evolved in a rather complex, as everything in South Africa has evolved, a complex manner, and complexity still typifies church life. Nonetheless, the enduring drive for freedom has persisted against considerable odds and continues to gain momentum. The relationship between the church and the African National Congress is critical. The African National Congress, which the United Nations recognizes as the legitimate voice of the majority of South African people, is considered the largest and most influential political organization in South Africa. It is also the oldest political organization on the continent of Africa. Leaders of the ANC until just a year ago were serving life sentences in South African jails, underground in South Africa, or in exile. Leaders like Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Joe Slovo, Govan Mbeki, Oliver Tambo have all reached mythic proportions in the minds of millions of South African citizens. School children as young as 5 years old dance, march, and sing to songs extolling these people as the authentic leaders of South Africa. The ANC has always had a close relationship with the church. Many of the early leaders of the ANC were Christian clergy and leading lay people. Recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, Chief Albert Luthuli, an important ANC leader during the 40s and 50s, was a Methodist minister. The present president of the African National Congress, Oliver Tambo, pursued the Anglican priesthood before becoming a lawyer, and to this day says that he, had he not gone into politics, he would be a priest. He holds a license to function as a lay minister with our church. Nelson Mandela is a committed Methodist churchman. The Reverend Fumankila Biba is the chaplain of the African National Congress and is in charge of the ANC's Department of Religious Affairs. He is an Anglican priest trained in South Africa. For the past 28 years, plus or minus, the church has provided leaders such as Tutu, Busak, Nadia, Chikani to fill the black political vacuum, while people like Mandela, Sisulu, Slovo, Tambo, etc. were cut off from the daily lives of the people of South Africa in places like Soweto, Crossroads, Langa, KwaZakhele, KwaMashu, Mamelodi, Sebokeng, Katlehong, and Tokoza. Now that these ANC leaders are free, what political role do the religious leaders play? In the case of Dr. Beyers Naudé, an Afrikaner who held the confidence of numerous nationalist leaders, he was the moderator of the Transvaal Synod of the White Dutch Reformed Church, a member of the secret Broederbond, an elite organization of Afrikaner men, and what used to be a strong advocate of apartheid legislation. For Nadi, it means a close alliance between church leadership and the ANC. It is interesting to note that Nadi broke with the Afrikaner folk or white tribe in 1963 and founded the Christian Institute, which was declared banned in 1977. Nadi was then banned for 5 years on October 19, 1977. Since the lifting of his banning order, he has served as Acting Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches and now heads the Ecumenical Advice Bureau while he is in his so-called retirement. During his retirement, Dr. Nadi serves as one of 12 members appointed by the African National Congress's National Executive to represent the ANC during initial rounds of negotiations with the South African government. It appears that the church and the African National Congress function together in the case of Dr. Nadi, a prominent church leader. Archbishop Tutu takes a slightly contrary view of the church's role with the ANC, or any political party for that matter. He has defended the Anglican Synod of Bishops' ban on ordained and licensed clergy from becoming card-carrying members of any political party. The Synod's decision was taken this past February, shortly after the major political parties were unbanned by the South African government after being prohibited from operating for some 30 years. Archbishop Tutu, addressing a group of Anglican students in Pietermaritzburg, explained the Synod of Bishops' decision in the following terms. One, it did not mean the church would become politically neutral. It would remain committed to justice. Two, it would be impossible for clergy to minister to parishioners of opposing political views if they were party members. Three, allowing membership of parties would prejudice church efforts to mediate in political conflict, particularly the efforts being made to bring together Inkatha, which up until just recently was a cultural organization of the largest tribe in South Africa, the 7 million Zulu tribe. Let me back up. I wanted to explain to you what Inkatha was, so it doesn't come out of the blue. But number three, allowing membership of parties would prejudice church efforts to mediate in political conflict, particularly the efforts being made to bring together NCATA and ANC-aligned forces in the Natal province. About 3,000 people in Natal have died in the ongoing war between these two groups in the past 3 years. A footnote to this is that there have been over 500 people who have died in the past 10 days. As long as I have been in and out of South Africa, there has never been so much bloodshed ever in South Africa than we have seen the last 10 days in Soweto between these two groups. The Archbishop has also said that he has already taken, in his words, a clobbering while he was General Secretary of the Council of Churches, because the Pan-Africanist Congress, which is a split-off group of the ANC and is orientation is that of black consciousness over and against the ANC, which is non-racial in its orientation. He was beat up by the Pan-Africanist Congress and groups like the Azanian People's Organization, which viewed the Council of Church, the South African Council of Churches, as a pro-ANC body. Tutu admits that the bishop's ruling might have come as a shock to many people, coming as it did soon after organizations dear to black South Africans had been unbanned. Quote, "We are sorry that maybe we didn't give opportunity for people to be able to discuss and understand the rationale behind it. But it is that we are aware it is in fact a matter of life and death." At a conference in Durban on July 7th of this year, Tutu went on to say that perhaps one of the most important roles the church has to play, apart from giving hope to people, is enabling people to know that it is possible for people with different points of view to coexist in one community. Africa is particularly of the view that when you disagree with me, you are my enemy. And because you are my enemy, the one thing you do with the enemy is you liquidate them. That's especially prophetic words when it came, looking back at the last 2 weeks. It is going to be quite crucial for South Africans to show that one person can hold one point of view and another person can hold another point of view and hold them so vehemently and yet at the end be able to break bread and drink at the same table and laugh. The South African church faces many challenges in the near and distant future. It needs to strive to model a non-racial and inclusive community that rises above its own history. The institutional church, especially churches that were founded by European missionary organizations, continue to support and be a part of the status quo, often a mirror image of racist institutions throughout South Africa. Tutu, Brissac, Chikane, Nadi, the South African Council of Churches, the Institute of Contextual Theology, and many other individuals and organizations, too numerous to count, represent a church of the, quote, fringe. The power structures of most churches include my own, the Anglican, yet, but especially the Dutch Reformed churches. They continue to be a part of the status quo and are part of functional apartheid. Historical factors will need redress. The end of racial apartheid will in no way spell the end of economic apartheid. This economic apartheid, which grows stronger by the day, will show itself as a form of classism once racial apartheid disappears. There has got to be economic reform on a massive scale. There needs to be a dramatic redistribution of wealth for people in South Africa. Because the African National Congress, the nationalist government in power now, and other South African political organizations, the church plays an important role in this economic reform. Labor-intensive development projects organized by churches around South Africa are a bright ray of hope. In the village of Lusikisiki in the Anglican Diocese of St. John's in the Eastern Cape area, a church has started an irrigation system and a seed potato program for a rural self-help plan which has been advised by the diocesan development officer. The Anglican Diocese of Grahamstown has started a project at their rural Southwell mission that has helped people to start their lives over again after being forcibly removed from their family houses, their family homes, by the government. Southwell provides rudimentary housing, pig runs, chicken coops, small vegetable plots, and a place of worship and hope. Another church project in Port Elizabeth has started a dry cleaning business that has brought income to families that have lived on the poverty line for decades. As apartheid crumbles, the church, as a prophetic voice, sometimes a loud and uncompromising Old Testament voice, needs to move from protest, confrontation, struggle, to a humble group involved in the development of the whole person and the whole community without losing its ability to call the government to account, irregardless of that government's political stripe. There is a lot of hope in South Africa. Lots of hope.
It was fun for me to take this assignment because when Ross Peterson asked me to do it and told me the title of the paper, I thought it would have to do with my ancestry. Because I am an African by descent. My ancestors were 1820 settlers who went to South Africa as the first English settlement in that country to separate the Afrikaner from the Africans on the South African eastern frontier around Grahamstown. And then in 1856, the Mormon missionaries showed up and converted a number of those people, including my great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, and hauled them off to Utah, where they pioneered here. Then I discovered that the paper is generic, and the reference to the word church, and I found that out last night, which was when I received the paper, and found out that it referred to the church being the community of Christian believers in South Africa. Nonetheless, it's an important paper for us to consider as we consider the role of Christianity in a very troubled society. I believe the thesis of Mr. Peterson's paper is found in this statement. It is my view that the struggle for freedom in South Africa cannot be adequately understood apart from an analysis of the role of religion, especially in the land of apartheid. Religion has played an important part in the defense of apartheid as well as in the critique of it. I agree with that. I think that's a valid thesis and a very important thesis for us to understand. Throughout South African history, Christian churches, and especially Christian missions, and wonderful Christian individuals have and continue to have a very important role in ameliorating the conditions in South Africa. And Mr. Peterson illustrated that in just a couple of cases, and there's so many wonderful, rich examples of that that extend over 100 years, and I wanted to refer that to that just a little bit. Because one area of this paper that concerns me is that it tends to generalize the problem of South Africa when the Christian role in South Africa is such a personal thing. So many wonderful examples could be made. My study of South African history shows great distinctions between the churches and the missionary societies, one from another. And I think I would agree with the general evaluation of the LMS as being very narrowly defined in terms of saving souls. Their way of operation was a very racist way of operation in many, many cases. And yet they gave to the Africans, even then, so much. It always impresses me that every single African leader struggling for independence and struggling for the opportunity that the blacks should have never lost has been done in the language of the colonial rulers. The ability to write and make articulate statements about their plight has been directly the product of South African education. And I think this paper would have been greatly strengthened if it had talked about the role of Christian missions in educating black people, giving them an opportunity to take leadership, take mastery for themselves. It's kind of interesting. We have people like Bishop Tutu who've risen to the very top of their church and presiding over a multiracial church. Remember that Bishop Tutu is the archbishop of a church that comprises many of the racial group, all of the racial groups of South Africa. And he's not the first. Back in 1965, when I first went there, I met the leader of the Methodist Synod in South Africa, who was a black man, who by the rules of the society had to administer an essentially white church from a black township because of the rules of apartheid. So there has been that wonderful tradition of leadership that rose through the church. Remember that until apartheid, almost all education in South Africa for the non-white people was provided by Christian missions. Very important movement. And I think this paper mentions the Moravians. But the wonderful story of the Moravian church coming from what is now Czechoslovakia, but what was then part of Germany. The Moravian Brethren went down to South Africa and founded a mission station at a place called Genadendal, translated Vale of Grace, to teach the bastardized offspring of a white society that were rejected by that society the love of Christ, but more important, I won't say more importantly, but additionally, how to survive in a hostile society, how to make a practical life for themselves. And the skills that that society taught frightened the government, and they expelled the missionaries, and it was only many, many years later when they were allowed back. But I went to Genadendal and saw that wonderful community that represented two centuries of mission labor, giving people a sense of self-worth and a sense of Christian love. Those are very important things to me. And I could mention other examples. I could mention Lovedale, for example, where Scottish missionaries taught Africans, gave them a hope, sent them overseas to become full-fledged ordained ministers in their churches in the 19th century. And this is one of the things that makes South Africa so strikingly different from so many other countries in Africa, because the Christian missionaries were there so long and gave an opportunity for leadership among the black people. And around the turn of this century, some new people came to South Africa, Americans. American missionaries of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And went down there and shocked the black people as well as shocking the white people. A church of black people from the United States Christianizing black people of South Africa. And it led to the beginnings of the whole array of these wonderful independent churches which Mr. Peterson mentions. And I need to tell you what they are because you may not know. But those independent Christian churches are churches that are syncretic, that have brought together Africans who gave birth to their Christianity through the mission churches, through the conventional Dutch Reformed, LMS, Anglican, Catholic, who separated from them because there was no opportunity for leadership under the white dominance of those societies. So they went out and formed their own churches. Great, exciting, fun organizations. You go down the streets of Soweto, and there you see an African version of the Relief Society. Women wearing wonderful costumes with sashes, green sashes, walking down the street, gathering their sisters to go to their weekly ladies' meeting of a church you never heard of, a church which brings vitality and hope and self-help to an oppressed people in an apartheid society. And as Mr. Peterson points out, over 300 of these organizations, and sometimes they last for the lifetime of one man who brings them into being, and sometimes they catch fire and they draw more and more membership. The largest of these churches is the Church of Jesus Christ as manifest through the ministry of Simon Kimbangu, It's a church that exists in Zaire, which has in excess of 3.5 million members. It's a church nobody ever heard of, but it's a church that was formed by, according to the founder, by revelation from God on April the 6th. For you who are not a Mormon, that's the date that the Mormon church was founded, by revelation. But this is a whole new expression of religion that has brought vitality and hope and leadership in a country where it was wanted. And so when you talk about the changing realities of South Africa, you can't understand them if you don't understand these 3.5 million adherents to churches you never heard of. It's tremendously important for us. The paper does mention, and it was just a little disconcerting to me, I hope I can find it. Yes, in the paper, Mr. Peterson says the institutional church, generic, the institutional church, especially churches that were founded by European missionary organizations, continue to support and be part of the status quo, often a mirror image of racist institutions. Yes and no. Because he himself has brought to our attention some very wonderful people who come out of that experience, who are valiant fighters against apartheid in South Africa. And so, rather than putting the emphasis on those who perpetuate apartheid, which is absolutely a part of the system, that other part, critics of the system and dedicated pioneers opposing the system, are right there in those same churches today. And that's a very important force for us to be prepared to live with. I think it would have been useful for us. We did get the ethnic origins of the various Dutch Reformed churches, but I think it would be very important for us to know the membership breakout of the churches, especially the Methodist and the Catholic, the Moravian, in terms of their ethnicity, because this is a society with a very large commitment to Christ among the black, among the colored, among the deprived peoples of the society. These are joint statistics of all the people of South Africa, and you did identify 3.5 million blacks in the African Independent Churches, but there's a very large support for Methodism. There's a very large support for the Catholicism among the black people of South Africa. And that's important for us to know, because that membership is going to have an important role to play in the change which this title refers to. I would also like to draw to your attention that the reforms which the national government has belatedly come to accept as reality and necessary came into being because of the Dutch Reformed Church. Before the national government of South Africa began to implement revision to the apartheid laws, the Dutch Reformed Church rather shocked their national party cronies by declaring apartheid unchristian. And so the Dutch Reformed Church itself, which was the backbone of apartheid and the philosophical underpinning of it, became the agency to induce reform. And we can't overlook that. We can criticize it for coming so late. We can criticize the long period of time in which they fostered apartheid. Let's give them credit for the fact that they have championed the opposition of apartheid also. Well, this is an important subject. I'm glad to see Mr. Peterson presenting it here and in other places, whether it's in this form or other forms. It's a message that needs to get across. If there's hope, as Mr. Peterson says in his conclusion, that hope is going to rest with brotherhood, sisterhood. That hope is going to rest with people who rise above the immediate political squabbles that are destroying the lives of so many good people today. It's going to come if people understand the broad humanity of man and the sonship of human beings in the Church of Christ. I congratulate you on the topic.
Mr. Peterson, do you have any further things you'd like to say?
Never asked a minister that.
Or would you rather have questions from the audience?
I want to just say 30 seconds, maybe to provoke all of you a little bit. This is such an important topic to me. This formulated in my mind and was put on paper long before what happened, what started to happen, what has been happening for centuries, in essence, but what's been dramatically fomenting up right now in Soweto. I would encourage you to look behind the newspapers, look beyond the television sets. The fact that the Los Angeles Times had an article about this big off the wire today about the violence in South Africa. It is an injustice to everyone outside of South Africa. It largely has to do with the Middle East right now. We are probably in the worst period of violence in South Africa that we've seen in recent years. You know, we talk about the Soweto massacre. We talk about Sharpeville, but none of them really approach what is happening right now. And they analyze and look deeply into that and not just see it strictly in terms of a tribal sort of warfare. There's ideologies involved. The government weaves its way in and out. There are political parties who've never been able to organize in their countries until 7 months ago. They never had a tradition of cake sales and getting the vote out. They're learning during their infancy. So, I'd like, if you have any comments on that subject. Because I glossed over that, and this is a simplification.
Yes, unfortunately, these events are so current. We're talking about tending. Obviously, they have roots that date back to that, beyond that. But here you're talking about two of the most important black organizations. This paper largely refers to the ANC because that's recognized by the United Nations and recognized by the South African government. But it is only one of several black organizations that are going to have their say before a settlement comes in South Africa. And the thing that strikes me as Americans, as Canadians, as British people, we accept opposition as being essentially loyal. Now, the idea of her loyal opposition is an extremely revolutionary idea. Could you imagine President Reagan refusing to leave the White House and canceling the last election? That thing happened in an election in Lesotho in Southern Africa. The Prime Minister allowed an election to occur, and when he found it was him, he staged a coup from the Prime Minister's office. And what you have here is a sparring for political power between two black people. We're talking about thousands of deaths that are being caused by blacks against blacks. It has nothing to do with the whites are not killing blacks. It's blacks killing blacks. And that's why a paper like this is so vital for us to understand. To understand the historical undergirdings that Christianity has had such a vital role to play in. And Mr. Peterson's absolutely right. The message that you should get from this paper and from my comment on this paper is this is a very complex situation and you can't get pat answers. And one of the most dangerous things that we were talking about just before we came to this panel. One of the most dangerous things that's happening in this country is the urge for simplicity. You jump on the ANC and you give your support to the ANC position, not realizing that's one of many points of view that have to be ironed out. And if you look to the rest of Africa, you can understand the concerns of the whites in South Africa. where country after country, the political transition has been one person, one vote, one time. And then that charismatic leader comes to power and outlaws every opposition party and remains in power until the military throws him out. And that's a dangerous thing in a society as diverse as South Africa, as Mr. Peterson has tried to show you.
Another important area to understand in South Africa is the whole homeland situation. This is a creation of the Nationalist Party. The Root and his cronies cooked it up. They put people in power that were controlled, who continue to be controlled, and in the pay of the South African government. And that's a whole other layer that is hard to get behind. I am not personally, as an activist, I'm not an academic. I see myself as an activist. I love simplicity because I want people to move ahead and act on their convictions. I have a hard time with Chief Buthelezi, who is a member of my church. He is in the pay of the South African government. His homeland is a creation, it's an archipelago of eroded spots all over the Natal countryside. You can tell when you're in Natal and when you're in the homeland by just taking a look at the vegetation elsewhere. And even as it's like irrigated land and eroded land, you can guess which belongs to the country. But up until 10 days ago, my attitude was, you know, he's irrelevant, he's played himself out, he only has 2% of the support of South Africa outside of his province, and in the urban areas of Natal are overwhelmingly pro-Mandela and pro-ANC. I thought of him so. I thought he was someone that Mandela and the ANC and the South African government could just cast aside as being irrelevant. In a way, the government is as guilty as the ANC of regarding Dr. Buthelezi as their own. And I would have said that to myself.
And you see, he hasn't even mentioned the PAC, and the other groups, the Tanzania, these groups who are also vying for allegiance.
And another interesting note, and get out there and see popular movies, even read popular books. I'll say this in front of an academic, read The Covenant, you know. Talks all about 1820.
Read it
somewhere. Or encourage other people to read it, just to motivate them to dig deeper. But the movie Cry Freedom, which is a look at the life of Donald Woods, who is the editor of East London newspaper, and the life of Steve Biko, is an interesting backdrop to a lot of political maneuvering going on right now in South Africa. In that Biko was a PAC-oriented person in his own ideology. But a lot of the followers of the Black People's Congress and these other organizations that Biko started now have moved to the ANC. And so the political situation is very fluid. People who I knew as nationalists are now card whites, are now card carrying members of the ANC today. It's on its hand.
I think we've got a question in the audience.
Well, I've understood that it's a very openly redistribution of wealth. I have three questions. I presume that nobody's going to give up wealth building.
No, never.
So they'll, they don't give up injuries, do they, Bill? I presume you're going to use government force to take from those who have wealth and give it to those. In other words, the presumption is that there has to be some force applied somewhere and maybe you've got a different way to do it, but I ask you, how do you square this with the commandment not to steal?
Well,
then the second question is, after 20 years, some people have been frugal and careful and prudent and are saving well. And
totally up to any point here? Are you going to redistribute what you can? And the third question, if you are going to redistribute what you can, what incentive is there for somebody to acquire wealth or to create wealth if it's going to be redistributed by the most, let's say, by the most virtuous, fair, decent person who won't take any for himself? But even if that happens, what incentive is there that wealth is not somewhat protected? What incentive is there to create it in the first place?
Can you gentlemen answer in 1 minute?
Let me mention just this point. The status of wealth in South Africa has largely been politically determined in the past. Therefore, there's no future to South Africa without addressing the problem of wealth. However, I don't think that wealth necessarily has to be stolen in order to be redistributed. Unless you regard taxation and the form we have in the United States as stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, which you may do. But the rich will be able to retain their wealth while still redistributing in a very substantial way the major shares of the wealth.
It's not for me to prognosticate. I have no idea what's going on. I know that there are numerous conferences going on between the African National Congress and members of the white business establishment. They've been going on for years now talking about this. I don't hear any talk within the ANC at least. I know it's not there in Congress and other political movements about wholesale socialism. I think that we will see some kind of mixed economy, but that is something that's